Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta. You call them sneakers. We Canadians call them runners. People in England refer to them as trainers. I don't know what Paul Simon calls them, but I don't really care because this is a guy who is okay with you calling him Al. What is that all about? No matter what you call them, the history of athletic footwear is very interesting. But you don't have to take my word for it. And why would you, since I call them runners? But you can trust Nicholas Smith. He's the author of Kicks, the great American story of sneakers.
Sneakers are one of those things that on the surface seems like a very simple object, but the more you dig into it, the more you find that it touches areas of business and fashion and sports and advertising and all sorts of other things. So I wanted to explore the history of American culture in the 20th century through the lens of sneakers. And this is just a great way to do it because it has so many different facets that you may not think of when you think of shoes. I mean, what other object is worn by Michael Jordan, Kurt Cobain, and Mr. Rogers?
Yes, and the Ramones as well.
Yeah, that too. And, you know, they may have even worn the same sneaker at one point, Converse All-Star.
It's a fascinating history. And speaking of the Converse All-Star, the Converse Rubber Shoe Company was one of the first adopters of the celebrity endorsement when they hired Chuck Taylor to sell their shoes. Yet Taylor wasn't really a celebrity at the time he was selling the Converse sneakers in the 1930s, was he?
Yeah, that's correct. He was a traveling salesman. He did play what he called professional basketball in the early 1920s. Now, that style of basketball today would be more semi-pro. And his playing time was very, very short. So by today's standards, we wouldn't think of him as a basketball celebrity. But you are correct that his fame came from traveling from town to town holding these basketball clinics. Now, he was also a coach, so he did know what he was talking about. And for many people, this was the first time they met anyone connected to a semi-pro or even professional level of the game that was telling them useful pointers. Now, of course, at the end of these basketball clinics, there was always the sly tip to, well, you know, you could play your game a bit better if you played in Converse All-Stars. And after a few years of doing this, going from town to town, Converse decided to name the All-Star sneaker after him. So the Chuck Taylor signature to this day is still found on every shoe.
And here we are in 2018 still talking about Chuck Taylors. Why have these shoes endured? Why do they still remain so popular?
I think it has to do more with the simplicity of the shoe. It can be worn with almost any outfit. It can be worn by almost any person. I mean, I've seen grandmothers here in Austria wear the Chuck Taylors. I've seen teenagers wear them. I've seen babies wear them.
Wow.
And it doesn't matter who you are, it seems like you can wear sneakers in general, but with this shoe in particular, you can wear this shoe and make it your own.
Yeah.
Even though it's the same thing that you can buy anywhere else in the world.
One of the most fascinating stories in your book concerns the founders of the Adidas and Puma shoe companies. They were these two German brothers who didn't get along very well. Can you tell me about them?
In the 1920s and 30s, there were these two brothers, the Dassler brothers, Adi Dassler and Rudolf Dassler, and they had an athletic shoe company. Now, in those days in Germany, the athletic shoes, usually soccer cleats or track shoes. And after the war, they had a falling out, and neither brother wanted to leave their small Bavarian town. So one brother established his athletic shoe company on one side of the town's river, and the other brother established it on the other side. One company was called Adidas, one was called Puma, and they're still based there today. And for a number of years, these two companies and the employees of these two companies didn't exactly mix. It was a bit of a Montagues and Capulets situation in their town. You know, if you visit the town cemetery today, the brothers are buried on opposite sides. So even in death, there was still this rivalry between Adidas and Puma.
Yeah, and the Adidas name, obviously, that comes from Adi Dassler, a condensation of his name, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It's not what many people think, an abbreviation of All Day I Dream About Sports. It was just the first three letters of his first name and last name.
Yes. We can't really talk about the history of sneakers without talking about the University of Oregon's legendary track coach, Bill Bowerman. How did he influence the history of sneakers?
Bowerman, like any track coach, wanted his athletes to have the best times possible. But he kind of took it to an additional level. So he would build his own track surfaces to see if this made his athletes run faster. He would try to have his athletes wear the lightest clothing possible to shave every couple every few ounces off of the weight that they had to carry. And this also translated into shoes. Now, he reasoned that the less a shoe weighed, of course, the faster you could go because you're carrying less with you with every step.
Sure.
So he would actually make shoes specifically for his athletes. So he would trace the athlete's foot around, he would build a shoe out of this, and you know, these shoes were not meant to last beyond more than a couple races, so in some cases the shoes fell apart during the race itself. But he was a self-taught shoemaker. Now, flash forward a few years, and this catches the eye of one of his former runners, a middle distance runner by the name of Phil Knight. And Phil Knight had traveled to Japan after graduating grad school from Stanford. And he saw that the Japanese were making shoes that were almost as good as the German shoes of the time, almost as good as the Adidas and Puma shoes, but of course could be sold for much cheaper. So he went into a company which we now know today as ASICS. At the time it was called Onitsuka Tiger. And he basically talked his way into being Tiger's import person to the western coast of the U.S. So he kept his old track coach in mind when he went back, and the two formed a company called Blue Ribbon Sports, which of course we know today as Nike.
Yeah, that's interesting. And another thing that Bill Bowerman did was that he basically invented the waffle sole, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. He was a relentless tinkerer. So even though he would make a shoe for his athlete and the athlete would actually finish the race in the shoe, he wanted to know what could he do to make it better. Now, Oregon's climate is very wet, it's very rainy, it's very muddy and soggy, so the athletic shoes of the time that were used for what we would call jogging, the sole wasn't exactly a sole that you would use to run in the mud and then on the pavement and then through the forest. It didn't have enough grip. So he was obsessed with finding some sort of sole pattern that had a good enough grip for these things. Now, as the story goes, he was at home one Sunday, and he looked over at his wife's waffle iron, and then he had an idea. Immediately, he went and poured molten rubber inside this waffle iron, and it fused together. But after a few more tries, he found the waffle pattern that he was looking for.
He was a perfectionist, and didn't they discover, I think, after he died, a whole bunch of old waffle irons in his garage?
Yeah, that's right. And one of them is housed in Nike's headquarters on display. It's kind of an ode to the inventor culture that first spawned the company.
Yeah. You say that one of the unlikeliest cameo appearances in the history of sneakers is made by an African-American doctor named Gerald W. Deese. Can you tell me about Dr. Deese and the cameo role he played in the history of sneakers?
Yeah, Dr. Deese was a internist at the Jamaica Hospital Medical Center in Queens. Living in Queens in the 1980s, there was lots of crime on the streets. Mm-hmm. And what Dr. Deese saw was young men were getting very wrapped up in sneakers and other things, and he kind of attributed this crime and negativity to shoes, among other things. So he wrote a poem called Felon Sneakers, where he kind of saw as this troubling trend of kids wearing their shoes without laces as prison inmates did. And one of those lines in the poem, I'll quote right here, is, "You shoot and kill, you're wearing those sneakers, but you've lost your will." Now, a little bit later, a hip-hop group called Run DMC kind of gave an ode to this song in their song, My Adidas, which is, of course, an ode to their Adidas shell-toe superstar shoes. And the line in that song is, "I wear my sneakers, but I'm not a sneak." So it's kind of taking what this well-meaning but misguided doctor wrote and then turning it into a pop culture touchstone with their song.
Just getting back to Deese, didn't he or somebody turn the poem Felon Sneakers, turned it into a rap song, didn't they?
Yeah.
You felon sneakers can't fill the bill. You got to know yourself to be really chill. When you rob, you rape, you shoot and kill. You wear those sneakers, but you lost your will.
Keep the peace, young brother.
So that couplet you quoted from Felon Sneakers, "You shoot and kill, you wearing those sneakers, but you lost your will," Deese felt that imitating the way inmates wore shoes would hold young black men back. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's fair to say. Run-DMC kind of saw it a different way. They saw it as sneakers were empowering. They were their way of expressing themselves. The group is identified so closely with those sneakers, and sneakers ended up becoming a positive thing for them. So this kind of speaks to just the many varied ways we can read into one single type of shoe.
The 80s really were a pivotal decade in terms of sneaker history, because something else that happened was in 1984, Nike paid $500,000 to a young NBA draft pick named Michael Jordan. What impact did that have on the evolution of sneaker culture?
They made a whole line of sneakers just after him, the Air Jordan shoes. Now, this at the time was still a very unique occurrence. What made this shoe unique wasn't necessarily the shoe itself, was the marketing campaign they designed around it. They enlisted the help of a young director named Spike Lee, who I'm sure everyone has heard of at this point. But in that day, Spike Lee wasn't very well known, and he especially wasn't well known in the small rural Arizona town where I grew up. So these Michael Jordan and Spike Lee commercials, who he starred in as his alter ego, Mars Blackmon, from his first movie, they were kind of the first taste the rest of America got of the young director.
Yo, Mars Blackmon here with my main man, Michael Jordan. Yo, Mike, what makes you the best player in the universe? Is it the vicious dunks?
No, Mars.
Is it the haircut?
No, Mars.
Is it the shoes?
No, Mars.
Is it the extra long shorts?
No, Mars.
It's the shoes then, right?
Nah.
Is it the short socks?
No, Mars.
Money's gotta be the shoes.
Shoes?
Shoes.
Shoes.
Shoes. You sure it's not the shoes?
I'm sure, Mars.
What about the shoes?
No, Mars.
Money's gotta be the shoes.
Do you think we've reached peak sneaker in terms of their popularity, or could they become even more popular?
I think they can become even more popular, but they're more popular now, and you can find more different types. You can find them in every color, every size, every fit than you ever could before. But, you know, until we get to the stage where we have the replicator on the Starship Enterprise that can make us anything we want, I don't think we're quite at Sneak Peeker just yet.
Yeah, or Peak Sneaker. I like Sneak Peeker better, actually.
Sneak Peeker has a good ring to it, but yeah, Peak Sneaker.
Nicholas Smith is the author of Kicks, The Great American Story of Sneakers. Get your kicks at WPR.org/beta.